Friendship, Aristotle spelled this out nicely when he talks about the types of friendship, like real deep friendship, is work. It's hard. It's wanting the best for the other. It's wanting to help them grow in virtue. It's wanting to help them flourish.
Welcome to Purposeful Lab, a Maja Center podcast. I'm Catherine Hadro with my co-host, Dr. Daniel Keebler. And looking forward to hearing this conversation, Dan, because this is an interview you did one-on-one on your home turf over in Steubenville.
Yeah, you got to speak with one of my colleagues in the psychology department, Dr. Matthew Bruninger, and we had an interesting conversation. We haven't had many psychologists on the podcast, and so it was good to sit down and talk to him about the role of psychology and understanding human flourishing and aiding humans as we try to reach our full potential.
Yes. Dr. Matthew Bruninger is the Associate Professor of Psychology at the Franciscan University of Steubenville, also the Director of Teaching Excellence. He's a licensed clinical psychologist. His academic interests comprise the intersection of faith and psychology, the psychology of religion, and virtue formation. He's also the author of Finding Freedom in Christ, Healing Life's Hurts. So again, this episode, perfect for season 5 as we're looking at human flourishing, is how psychology can be a tool for human flourishing and how to utilize it in that sense. But again, you know Dr. Bruninger, he's a friend of yours.
Yeah, and he's one of the best teachers we have at Franciscan University. He's very, very good. We collaborated on a grant together. We're looking at sort of the attitudes that Catholic seminarians have regarding science and religion issues. Mm-hmm. So He's an excellent teacher. He helps guide young faculty members at Franciscan in terms of their teaching and how to relate to the students better. And he's a practicing clinical psychologist. So,
well, I'm excited to listen to this. So let's just get right to it. Here is Dan's conversation with Dr. Matthew Bruninger.
Well, Matt, thanks for joining us today on the Purposeful Lab podcast. It's great to have you on.
I'm happy to be here.
We haven't had on the podcast, we have a lot of different disciplines represented. Yeah, we've had theologians, philosophers, evolutionary psychologists, biologists, chemists, physicists. But I don't think we've had full-blooded psychologist.
Clinical psychologist.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so maybe to get started, will you just... tell people sort of what got you, psychology is a study of the human mind and behavior, what motivates people.
Yeah.
So what got you motivated to study psychology?
See what you did there. Yeah, see what you did there. It's funny. For me, my dad, growing up, my dad was a drug and alcohol counselor.
Okay.
And so I really, I loved my dad and I really admired him, and I kind of wanted to, not uncommon, kind of looking up to your parents and maybe wanting to follow in their footsteps. So for a long time, I thought I wanted to be a counselor because my dad's a counselor.
Yeah.
Went to college, started up bio pre-med, then sort of took a detour, took a long way, went to psych for a while, eventually settled on English literature. But what's fascinating as I sort of look back, everything that I studied, I always was interested sort of in the psychological dimension. So what fascinated me about English literature was how authors chose to write characters, Shakespeare writing King Lear, Lear's descent into madness. I was fascinated by his ability to capture what it looks like to lose grasp of reality. Why does one character fall in love, in Brothers K? What motivates love or anger or pride? To see the character formation is what sort of always interested me about literature.
Yeah, that's all good. All good literature has at its core some psychological struggle going on.
I think so. Yeah. And I felt like that's what drew me. But I also sort of came back to the faith of my childhood in college. And so I really wanted to understand it more and learn more about it. And so I went and got a master's degree in theology as a way to sort of dive into to faith. The Catholic faith in particular. And at the program I was at Ave Maria University in Naples, Florida, and we were reading a lot of St. Thomas Aquinas. And what struck me was that there was a rich psychological dimension to his writing. He's sort of known for his clarity in writing very sort of systematically and logically, analytically. But I kept wondering, there's something behind that. They're like, all of this has to take place in the context of a human person.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And so in particular, his work on virtue and moral development, moral formation, a moral act, I kept thinking, like, it sounds so easy, neat, and clean. Like, you know, if you want to be patient, do patient things. You're like, okay.
Don't have kids.
So it's like, I didn't quite know how to square the two. Like, and it got me thinking quite a bit about what are the psychological experiences that can either aid or hinder some of the stuff that seems so clearly articulated in St. Thomas.
Yeah.
Faith, virtue, vice. There's like our lives, our history, there's so many psychological aspects, our self-esteem, our perceptions of our own autonomy. How do these play a role? Traumatic experiences. How do these play a role in virtue, vice, faith, our ability to use and exercise our intellect and will? These were questions that were sort of burning for me. And I thought, you know, I don't think I'm a very good theologian, but I think I could be a good psychologist. And these are the questions I'm interested in and always have been in some way. And I went back to psychology. And so I went to Baylor University and got a degree in clinical psych and worked with a guy who was really interested in psych of religion stuff in particular.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, that's like psychology of religion. It's kind of fascinating to me. And, you know, on two levels. One, the level of like, why are humans religious? Mm-hmm. Just on a purely, so from a secular standpoint, even if you're not a believer in God, why are humans religious? Why is this ubiquitous? And then what does it do for you psychologically? And then the second part that you're talking about. So I want to get into both of these. The second part, you know, the virtue formation and how does our psychology, is it tied to that? But maybe let's start with the first one.
Sure.
Versus what is it psychologists see, like the role of religion in human flourishing, right? Just from that standpoint.
Yeah. So there's, I can say sort of overwhelmingly, if you were to look at the literature on religion and faith, the overwhelming thrust of the literature is that people of faith, people who have religious values, people who participate in religious services, like pretty overwhelmingly, the literature shows that this is a good thing.
Okay.
It's positive. Okay. And it's come out of the psych literature. It's come out of, there's a guy at Duke, Harold Koenig, does stuff on religion and physical health, religion and emotional health. It's pretty ubiquitous. This stuff is like, faith and religion are pretty good for us. And they give us some, oftentimes better than average outcomes in overall well-being, happiness, this sort of thing. Now there's a myriad of caveats there.
Yeah.
Right. I wrote a paper with a woman at Case Western Reserve named Julie Exline, and her real interest is religious and spiritual struggles, that there are dimensions of religion and spirituality that are difficult and cause tension and cause turmoil. And so we have to pay attention to this. And we're not talking about like religion, the research, right? You can get very specific and look at like aspects of religion that can be harmful. It's obviously like religious trauma, and there's so, but on a whole, if you take it as a whole, people who are engaged in faith practices and religion tend to do better on average in domains of like flourishing and well-being.
Yeah. And is that like, because I've read things about just having like a transcendent experience versus religion. Are those like going out and seeing a beautiful landscape or a large tree, and you get that, that feeling that of awe or wonder.
Yeah, good question.
And there's some overlap, obviously, with religion. You have that sense of awe and wonder, but is there something, you know, besides, like, you know, in religious practices go beyond nature worshiping, you know, that thing, you know, and is there something about, what do you think on that?
That's a really good question. And I'm not sure, let me say this. I'll kind of give as good of an answer as I can without hopefully getting out over my skis. Oftentimes in the literature now, what you see is they'll talk about religion and spirituality together.
Okay.
They're different constructs. And so you oftentimes see them grouped together, and they'll be designated R/S, religion and spirituality.
Yeah. Okay.
And so one of the distinctions is something like spirituality is something that connects you to the transcendent, a transcendent experience. religion is sort of spirituality within the confines and construct of a sort of dogmatic or doctrinal belief.
And a community too? Is that
community? Absolutely. Yeah. Community dimension or aspect. Absolutely. And so sometimes they get pulled apart and looked at separately. I wish I could tell you I'm not aware of, and I can't bring to mind right now, any studies that I'm familiar with that look at them separately and say religion is more potent than spirituality. Or almost all the work I've done and most of what I've read kind of lumps them together.
Yeah.
Even though the papers will always make a distinction. Okay. So I wish I actually knew that literature base better to answer that question.
Yeah.
I'm a little embarrassed that I don't, to be honest.
Well, it's an interesting, you know, because there's a big overlap there, but it's clearly distinct.
Yeah, they are just
point out
absolutely.
In the way they go. One of the things, as a biologist, I'm always fascinated the link between our biology and our psychology, right? And we, in the podcast, we talk about sort of the order that we see in the universe, and the chemistry gives rise to the biology, or the physics gives rise to the chemistry and the order. Yeah. You see this emergent order.
Yeah.
And it points towards, what you might see at the next level. So what is it you think about, think about the biology?
Yes.
What does that tell us, or our biology tell us, is giving hints about what's going to make us psychologically flourish, right? What is it, the connection there, right?
I think maybe the single most important thing, I can maybe highlight two things. One is that we have a social brain.
Yeah.
Right. And that to me is so profound. And speak so much to our utter and absolute need, not only for just relationships, but for a certain quality of relationship. I could sort of talk later about maybe what those qualities are, but we are social creatures that need particular types of relationships to flourish. The second thing is our prefrontal cortex that allows us to plan and engage in pattern recognition and see future consequences of present actions, and sort of controls inhibition. That prefrontal cortex gives us the ability to engage in reflecting on ourselves.
Yeah.
We're one of the few creatures that can reflect on its own life and where its life is going. We're one of the few creatures that can see and recognize our own annihilation in the future.
Yeah, right.
I mean, other animals don't think about their death. Human beings think about their death. And there's a whole field of psychology or a whole theory called terror management theory that basically says religion is just a coping mechanism because we know we're going to die.
Right.
But that prefrontal cortex gives us also this ability to recognize an end toward which we might be ordered. And so for me, the other big thing is purpose and meaning. Purpose and meaning. To have our actions and our activities ordered towards something.
Yeah.
These two things, relationships and a sense of meaning or purpose or movement toward an end, and an end that we can sort of foresee and choose deliberately. Those two things seem fundamental, and they're rooted in certain brain capacities.
Yeah, right.
But they seem fundamental for our flourishing.
Yeah.
And we need direction. And we need people. And there's a few other things that will scatter in there that different theorists in this literature have talked about, but to have an end, and to have deep relationships.
Yeah, that's
really important.
That is, it's one of the things we've talked about previously on the podcast, sort of the difference between humans and other primates, even advanced primates, and this ability to reflect on what we're doing gives us psychology, right?
Yeah.
Because you don't really have psychology with an ape or with a chimp or even an advanced hominid. It's this idea that, I have this goal and I'm not meeting that goal. I'm not flourishing. Yeah. I'm not. And then if you reflect on that, that can lead to crashing. Right?
Yeah.
It's like a catch-22. This freedom, this openness we have to choose our goal gives us the bad side of psychological disorders, right?
Yeah. It's like these capacities that we have, right? These underlying abilities, they can give rise to really helpful adaptive things, but they can also be used sort of poorly. Yeah. And or because of disorder in creation,
right.
They can sort of break in certain ways.
Yeah.
But no, that's 100% right. We have this sort of self-reflective consciousness. We have this ability to look back on our own conscious experience. We have this awareness of what we're being aware of. Awareness of being aware.
Yeah.
Sometimes in psych, we'll talk about metacognition, thinking about how I think about things. This is a big part of therapy.
Yeah.
So when I'm working with a client, at least part of what we're trying to do is engage in metacognition. I want them to become aware of how they're thinking about certain things. Oh, I guess I see relationships like this.
Right.
Oh, I guess I've always assumed that they're thinking about their thought process. And that ability is it's a profound ability and capacity, one that actually is really helpful in the education literature. So like teaching students how to engage in metacognition actually tends to make them better students because they can see, oh, I thought about this material wrong. I thought about studying the wrong way. My approach to this was students who don't engage in metacognition tend to do the same things over and over and get the same results.
I'll bring you in my class. You can help these students.
Just tell them that.
It's not my fault. It's
your lack of
metacognition.
Well, so but it is our job to teach them how to be metacognitively aware. But
That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, you're talking about the therapy you do, and you have a book, Finding Freedom in Christ, about healing life's hurts. So these. You can tell us about that and sort of how that relates to what you just were referring to about people that are not sort of seeing the world and where they're meant.
I'll tell you, that book really came out of a large part of my clinical work and training was with substance abusers.
Okay.
And so I got really interested in reading some of the literature that they're steeped in. So like the stuff on Alcoholics Anonymous in particular, these 12-step programs.
Yeah.
So I wanted to sort of understand the language that my clients were using and the experiences that they were being exposed to. And I thought there was so much wisdom in these 12 steps. They really fascinated me.
Yeah.
And some of the wisdom I found there was this idea of sort of learning to be honest and open about our faults and failings, putting aside what some of the psychoanalytic or psychodynamic therapists might call our defenses or our defense mechanisms, learning to recognize them and say, oh, I'm using this to reduce my anxiety. Let me put this aside. Let me lay this aside. Let me acknowledge that I'm actually suffering here.
Yeah.
AA has this sort of unflinching honesty. They talk about doing a moral inventory, taking a good, hard look at myself. What are my defects and what are my strengths? They're rooted in a fellowship. You go to the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous because you need people. You need social connection. You don't just need the steps. You need to engage with others. They talked about the need to tap into a transcendent experience. The 12th step said having had a spiritual awakening is the result of these steps. And they define a spiritual experience as a radical shift in attitudes, ideas, and behaviors. A radical shift in how I used to think, how I used to act, how I used to feel. I thought there was so much wisdom there. So what I set out to do was translate it for a Catholic audience, give it some, like flesh out some of it.
Yeah.
And some of it was I tried to take some of the steps and sort of flesh them out in a Catholic framework.
Yeah. Yeah, you can see the back, the remnants of it, not the remnant, the image of it there that just needs, there's a lot of those things.
A lot
the things
of
you
things.
Hear in the Catholic spiritual life or even the Christian spiritual life.
Absolutely.
All those steps of just,
The AA basically says, here's your primary purpose today. Your problem is that you're too selfish, kind of think about yourself all the time. This makes you unhappy, angry, and depressed because you're thinking about yourself all the time. How life has hurt you, how you're not, how you're not getting what you want. We want you to become of maximum service to God and others. It's like AA says you have a new fundamental purpose. Help others. Each day, each moment, this is it. This is what you were made for. Yeah. And in some way, if you remember the old Baltimore Catechism, if you, like our primary end is like love God, love others, and be with him in heaven. And AA says something very similar. Like serve God, serve your fellow man, and this is where you'll find happiness. And I thought like they intuitively understood the literature on altruism, the literature on gratitude.
Yeah.
AA always said, they'll say, make a gratitude list. We have all this growing body of evidence on the importance, the psychological importance and benefit of gratitude. And this stuff is just woven. It's intuitive. It's in the air that 12-step programs breathe. And I was trying to pull it out, show how it's in the Catholic intellectual tradition and how it's in some of the psych literature.
Yeah.
And so that's what the book is about, ultimately, and how I think Christ gives us this experience of love and relationship, how we can open ourselves up to this. And the book is really, how do we recognize what's blocking us psychologically from this more profound experience of God's love and our ability to love and serve others?
Yeah.
That's what it's about.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that if you think psychology is pursuing the same truths that religion is, right?
Yeah.
That there's one truth out there that they should converge. And it seems like modern, I don't know, there's this mix here because you've got like in modern society, you never had more, I think, psychological books, resources, analysis, and so forth. And you've probably never had as much loneliness and psychological
issues.
But at the same time, I've never seen in my lifetime more psychological research that is showing, like, you know, that are synergistic with what we know by faith, that the people that are have gratitude, who are living for other people and coming outside of themselves.
So
it's just this weird thing where
it is weird.
Society's sort of falling apart on one side, but it seems like these answers are emerging from psychology that point towards we say, you know, the act of, you know, we do an examination of conscience. That is something that looking at us honestly, being open to the other person, not worrying about, hey, my needs, but somebody else's.
It seems to me that so many of the things that are inherent in the faith are supported. You can find empirical literature bases that support it. I was reading something the other day. It was an article about a study.
Okay.
It was coming out of the sociology literature. This guy looked at the general, I think it's called the General Social Survey, the GSS. And it's a huge database. And he looked over 30 years and he found that people with more sexual partners weren't happier in their marriages. That like it looked like people who actually had fewer sexual partners had greater marital bliss. And the article wrote it up as a surprise, like, in a surprising finding.
Yeah.
You might actually think that having more sexual partners before marriage like made you happier. But surprisingly, like those who had fewer were happier. And you sort of start to see like some of these interesting effects emerge from the sociology literature, like this weird cohabitation effect that we see.
Yeah.
Like, it seems that cohabitation actually is oftentimes like harmful to relationships. Like living together before you're married, the stuff that is in the, not that that's like a doctrine of the church, but some of the prudential things that the church would point us toward. And so I do think it's funny, man, where there's more psych literature out coming, like hitting us now than ever. But we also seem to be less happy.
Yeah, there seems to be more resources there for people. But why do you think that is?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, obviously people point to the social media, lack of quality relationships, and is that really what it is?
I mean, my approach is I'm skeptical of anyone who boils it down to like a single factor.
Yeah,
people are like it's the iPhone, and you're like,
it could be.
I think exactly. I mean, that's how I feel, right? Like maybe it's certainly that's a piece, right? Technology and social media are a piece, 100%. But like a lack of meaningful relationships.
Yeah.
Is a piece. You know, in our circles, like these theological circles, people will say like it's the absence of God. It's the absence of a clear moral sense. You're like, that's a piece, certainly. I think it's like, what I think it is sort of a convergence of all of these things.
Yeah.
We're lacking a coherent framework for our purpose in life.
Yeah. Right? If we don't, do we not have a coherent framework as a society? A lot of people don't have any way of coming up with what is my purpose.
Right.
And then all of these other things sort of fill that hole.
This is what's interesting. And so to your point about the research, the literature on well-being and flourishing is fascinating, right? And they've come up with some awesome things and they've recognized some really important things. There's lots of interventions, gratitude lists, what went well, how to boost positive emotion, how to get into flow states and heighten our engagement. They recognize, the literature says, like, look, these things are important. Here are interventions to do them.
Yeah.
But they sort of, like, they have to be hung in a broader framework. Life isn't just about interventions that boost positive mood.
Right.
Because we're the creature that will always ask, yeah, but why?
Why do I want to have a positive
mood? What for? That to me is, that God framework is important, I think. Losing that, losing a cultural sense of meaning and purpose and coherence, you're left with a vacuum, and we try to fill that. I get my what for? Is it my job? Is it like working? Is it to do some social good? What is my purpose?
Yeah,
and that to me seems really crucial. We're losing that, and so that, combined with technology, which can cause us to engage in this sort of social comparison where we constantly feel like we're failing. My Instagram, Ask a Catholic Therapist, by the way, on Instagram, is filled with 27-year-old guys who are all on steroids. They're all on gear and they're huge. And it's just pump videos of these guys. And I can look at that and be like, I'm falling behind here.
Well,
I don't have a six pack. I have nothing close to it, right? Like, I just keep going up in gene sizes the older I get. Like, I don't.
So what is your purpose then?
Yeah. It starts to look like we look for it in these things.
Exactly.
Yeah. And there's these movements in the circle my wife is rolling in. Like, you know, if you don't have a dairy cow and if you're not homeschooling and if you don't have, you're not milking in a dress and your kids aren't Montessori, and like, what's your purpose? What are you doing? We're just inundated by people who are saying, this is what you should be doing.
Yeah.
And it's overwhelming. We constantly feel like we're failing or falling short. We're not actually interacting with real people. We're interacting with, like, you know, technological projections of people. We're also like habituating our brains to digesting real tiny bits of information and sort of shortening our attention spans too. So then when we're actually asked to put our mind to a task, we're not used to like long sustained attention. I think all of this stuff coalesces and combines in modern culture to create what we're experiencing now.
Yeah.
So it's multifaceted. It's to reduce it to a single factor, I think, is a mistake.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think that the lack of deep reflection, that's one of the things about, you know, we're both in higher education.
Yes.
It's like, how do you get students to reflect deeper about things? And because that is the only way and myself, I'm guilty of this myself, stopping to reflect, to reset one rather than task, another task, another task. And I've got to keep up with my tasks so that, you know,
this is what therapy is. This is why I think therapy is so
fun. Let me tell you that. We're going to, the second half here is going to be my therapy session. So let me tell you about my,
you can't afford me, Dave.
No, I can't.
Listen, I think people today are desperate for this. And I think part of the reason therapy, and I think there's good therapy and there's not good therapy.
Yeah.
But part of what therapy does, even if you're seeing a bad therapist, part of the reason therapy is so popular is it's a dedicated time each week for self-reflection.
Yeah.
It's almost like we're at the point where we have to give ourselves permission to sit down and think about ourselves.
Yeah.
It's just time where I get to reflect and to think about how I'm feeling, to think about how I'm acting, to be deliberate and intentional about my self-reflection. And so for some people, that's just what therapy is. That's all they need.
Yeah.
They just need that time and that space. Look, in some ways, therapy is proliferating the culture because we've lost friendship. Do you know what I mean?
Sure, like, right.
And that's not to say that all mental health problems can be solved by friendship.
Sure,
that's not
sure.
What I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah.
I think there are times when a mental health professional is needed.
Without a doubt.
But I see, especially among men, like this sort of crisis of friendship. I don't even want to use, I mean, everyone uses, there's a crisis of everything, right? So I don't, like, I don't, like, the crisis of femininity, okay. What you really see among men, this sort of inability and uncertainty and lack of like male friendship. And for me, this was brought to a head a couple of years ago when I was talking to somebody and I was in my mid to late 30s and I said, oh, my best friend, Neil. And the second I said it, I felt like a little kid. I was like, oh God, I'm a grown man. Grown men don't have best friends. And then I caught myself, right? There's that metacognitive awareness.
Yeah, right.
I thought like, should I not have a best friend as a man? Is that child's play or should adults have best friends?
Yeah.
Should I have a friend who like knows me so intimately and so deeply and so, not just somebody who shares activities with me or tasks.
Right, yeah.
I got a buddy I fish with.
Right.
I'm talking about somebody who knows my weaknesses, my vulnerabilities, my insecurities. Somebody who, when I'm down and out and scared and overwhelmed, I call him and I go, dude, I'm in over my head. Or I just made a big parenting mistake. Or like, I'm having this marital struggle. What do I do?
Yeah.
I think we don't have that anymore. I mean,
now
the ancients had this. They thought about it.
Yeah.
But we've lost this. And I think we don't know how to, men don't seem to know how to do it.
It isn't modeled for men
at all,
right? So you don't look about, well, they've got, you know, in society, it's very, very, very.
Not in the States. Yeah. Not in the States. Yeah. We don't see it. Yeah. You sort of see these like, we're independent, autonomous men who like, and that sort of weakness. And we'll talk about like, dude, the wife's a real burden, you know, or like really nagging me. And the other guy goes, yeah. And that's like the depth of like our, you know. We'll fish next to each other with Marlboros in our mouth and kind of say like, my son's a bit of a disappointment. But like, friendship, you know, Aristotle spelled this out nicely when he talks about the types of friendship, like real deep friendship is work. It's hard. It's wanting the best for the other. It's wanting to help them grow in virtue. It's wanting to help them flourish.
Yeah,
and that means you're dialed in, you're zeroed in. It
takes time.
It takes time, and
is that a priority? You have to prioritize that. No, I'm going to spend time with this person or these people, and we're going to be deliberate about it.
When there isn't.
My experience is like unless I make a decision, you know, hey, this group, we're going to get together every 3 weeks,
right?
And it's very very difficult because it wasn't modeled to me.
And it's messy too, right? Like, I don't know, when I get to know somebody. And I let somebody get to know me, that means that you can move me, you can hurt me, I start to care about you.
Yeah.
And that means like, you can make me angry and you can make me sad.
Yeah.
And you can, like, I'm open to this depth of human experience that I think we're not super comfortable with.
Yeah.
And that depth is like an emotional, I don't know, you know, the Bible, Augustine, like the heart,
right.
and we're not, and not in some like just sentimental irrational way, but this sort of deep core of our being gets open to another person in the highest form of friendship, and that is that's a vulnerable and intimate place to be, and I think we need it, and we're made for our brain actually, you know, some of the particular studies on childhood development that I really like are the studies on attachment, sort of the emotional climate that parents need to create for a child's brain to unfold and to form connections in like the best, highest, healthiest way.
Yeah.
That the quality of the interaction really matters.
Yeah.
For connectedness, for connectivity, for brain fire. The brain that is in a state of sort of safety and security, the brain that feels connected to, seen, felt, known, soothed, unfolds in a healthy way.
Yeah.
And this is like parents giving us intimacy. It's parents modeling for us vulnerability. They're open to us. They can handle us. They can hold all of our experiences. And that becomes our cognitive template for future relationships.
Yeah.
It seems like a classic move to blame parents as a psychologist. Like, I bet the problem is your mom or dad. Right? But there is a sense in which how I parent, how I was parented.
Oh, I mean, I think everything. Anybody that's been married can look, you know, you talk to your spouse, it's a different family dynamic.
Yes.
In-law parents is like, there is. We are raised, the differences, and it really hardwires our behavior.
Yeah,
it really does. It becomes your habit.
Yes.
And we are relational, like you said, we are deeply the brains. We've talked about this before on the podcast with the neuroscientists, the brain is a relational organ.
Yes.
We are relational people. And that's a double-edged sword because we're meant for other people, but now we're inherently vulnerable to other people and what other people can do to us. But if they, you know, if it's that relationship is done properly, then we become a bearer of the potential of having good relationships and flourishing.
That is the stuff I love. Like when it comes to clinical psychology and working with patients, this to me is our relationship becomes the vehicle of healing.
Yeah.
And there are certain interventions and they're like, but they come through our human relationship.
Yeah.
And that to me, I mean, maybe back to your last point, maybe part of why we see such mental health problems today is because the quality of our relationships. We don't know how to be, even when we are in relation, approximately, we're at work together, we share space together, we don't know how to be together like at the deepest level of our being.
That's true.
And so on one hand, the movement, like sort of the boundaries movement. Boundaries are good. I talk about boundaries all the time. But on the other hand, sometimes we use boundaries because we actually don't know how to engage at a deep level where there's disagreement and disagreement's okay, but there's still love and affection and care and tenderness. And we can use any of these sort of psychology constructs in ways that actually drive us apart.
Yeah.
Rather than have us encounter each other. Politics, you know, is this deeply divisive thing. We've sort of learned how to disagree. We view the other as threats.
Right. Rather than someone that we can learn from or an opportunity to develop our view or something like that. And we talked, quite a bit about, just psychology in general and healing and so forth. I know you've done work on sort of virtue formation, where you were talking about at the beginning, how you got into psychology and how does the actual living out the virtuous life play out in a real live human person.
Right.
And I know you got this really cool class that you do on sort of virtue. I'd love tell me about this bread making class.
Yeah.
Not something you would think, oh, you know what, let's do bread making for virtue.
Yeah.
So what's this class?
So part of what I'll say is this is where I love doing collaborative work with people. So one benefit of being at a university is I have the opportunity to work with folks in the philosophy and theology department who have a real expertise in this stuff. So I have a buddy, Brandon Dahm, who teaches, ethics. He's really sort of well-versed in St. Thomas's Summa.
Yeah.
He has an interest in virtue, but he's also sort of psychologically minded, which is awesome. Yeah. So we were sitting down one day talking about parenting. We're at a coffee shop and sort of lamenting that the theological literature oftentimes just says, well, if you want to grow in virtue, if you want to be generous, do generous acts. It's like wonderfully unhelpful. And
if I did generous acts, I wouldn't need to grow.
Exactly. So I started saying, well, like, this is interesting, Brandon, because like, what about people who have been traumatized and sort of are in a constant state of fight or flight or threat mode? Mm-hmm. And so the world and everyone in it is perceived as threatening. And so they don't have the sort of disposition of openness, curiosity, attentiveness to the outside world. Or when they're in threat mode, their vision sort of narrows, their attention narrows to what's perceived as threat, and they miss all this other stuff. What about not having clear goals or meaning or purpose? What about, so I started saying all these things, and he was like, man, this is awesome. Like, we should sort of try to put bones on the flesh of this a little bit. Sorry, put flesh on the bones of this a little bit. And we just had a really great conversation that day. And part of what we started thinking about was Aristotle has this notion that to grow in virtue is sort of skill-like. It's sort of analogous to getting really good at a skill. So he wants to say, look at a skill that you've gotten good at, that you've become an expert in. And now, as you reflect on how you got better at that skill, that should give you some understanding of what virtue formation is like. The same things, you know, some of the same underlying principles that go into getting good at a skill underlie growing in virtue. This was Aristotle's idea. So we thought we could draw at least from some part of that. Now, I think there's, what we've done is we think there's a converging body of literature. So the skill literature is helpful here. The literature on expertise and how you become an expert and how experts see the world and see patterns, that's really helpful here.
Yeah.
The literature on goals and goal development and goal formation is really helpful here. So I think there's converging streams of literature that help us get a fuller picture. But we wanted to zero in first on the skill literature. And we wanted to give students a skill that they could practice getting good at. And we thought, sourdough bread baking.
Sounds good.
It's perfect, right? It's like it's relatively easy to get a decent loaf. You can really fine tune it like very precisely though. There's so many different ways you can zero in on how much flour, which flours, temperature of the water, how long you let it cook.
Yeah.
There's room to grow tremendously. So with very little practice, you can kind of get decent. You can practice it a lifetime to become an expert. It's bodily. It uses your hands. Yeah. It's not just an intellectual thing. It's bodily. It gets you involved sort of at every level of the senses. And so we thought we'll teach students how to make sourdough bread, let them reflect on that process, and use that reflection as a framework for them to understand some of this virtue literature, the virtue ethics tradition, the skill literature, having an end or goal in mind, the embodiedness of it all, the social dimensions of these things. So we came up with a class, and it's been called the bread class, although it probably should be called the virtue class. And we teach it in Austria over the summer, nestled in the Austrian Alps in a 14th century Carthusian monastery. And we wake up and we make sourdough bread, and we get our hands in it, and we pay attention to it. And we notice, and then we notice what we're noticing. And we notice how what we notice changes over the course of 3 weeks. How what you thought was important isn't important. How you see the whole, you're able to zoom out and see the whole, and then zoom into particulars a little more easily or readily in the particular process you're in.
Yeah.
How it becomes a feel, how it becomes, Aristotle says, and St. Thomas picks up on this, that virtue is like second nature. How you can sort of begin to like do something like you've always known how to do it.
Yeah.
It becomes, it's easy.
Yeah.
We teach them how to do that. And then we read Aristotle and Thomas and some of the skill literature and the expertise literature and the habit formation literature. What do habits have to tell us about virtue formation? So I will say this is it's a growing idea for us. There's all these different literatures that seem to provide a piece.
Yeah.
A piece.
It seems like a lot of different ways to go into this class. Yeah. You can do, add things and take things away. And how do the students?
I think they love
come out of it.
Yeah.
Do they see the connection with like the habit formation virtues and their self reflection?
Hope so.
Yeah.
I will say we've gotten really positive reviews on the class.
Yeah.
Part of that is, you're in the Austrian Alps, right? Part of it is it's an interesting topic.
Yeah.
I think they saw it. I think they did.
Yeah.
We've run the class one time. We're running it again this upcoming summer. And so I'm really excited because we're continually honing and we're stepping
you're
back,
doing it.
Looking at the process.
The same thing.
And so I think we're going to be able to drive it home even more clearly.
Yeah.
But this is part of growing in something, getting better in something, functioning at a higher level and pursuing excellence is stepping back, evaluating, reflecting, implementing, right? And so we're trying to sort of model this in our own process of how we think about the class. I think it was good.
Yeah.
But I think students, we could make the connection more clearly. We learned a lot about how long baking takes.
Yeah.
It's one thing when you're baking. It's another thing when you're teaching somebody how to bake. So we were totally off on our time estimates, yeah, like by a lot.
Okay. At least you can have something every day, right? It's so, not like brewing beer, which would
exactly
be you got to wait too long.
100%. There's like an immediate product.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And you kind of get pretty quick feedback on whether this is working or not.
Yeah,
did my approach work?
Right.
Yeah. Oh, it didn't. It's a flat loaf. It's a hard loaf. There's no air bubbles. There's too many air bubbles. You get pretty immediate feedback. And so the expertise literature is fascinating there, because the expertise literature says what we need is deliberate practice with quick feedback.
Mm.
Like that's how you get really good at something.
Yeah.
You practice it on purpose. You try to do something and then you get some feedback.
Okay.
And so we get that in this class. There's deliberate practice on certain aspects of baking the loaf, and then you get pretty quick feedback, not only from the loaf itself, but from the instructors.
Yeah.
So it's awesome. Yeah, no, it's been great.
Yeah, yeah. You talk about the similarities between practicing to learn a skill, but like in practicing to learn a virtue, but how are they different in the sense? There's this overlap, but
yeah,
it seems like harder to learn a virtue than it is,
yeah,
at least certain skills, right?
I'm
playing the piano or whatever, violin, I'll never do that, but it seems like virtue is even smarter.
It's harder.
Is there something qualitatively different that?
Yeah, there is. And this is part of what we did. Brandon and I wrote a paper on this. St. Thomas uses the word habitus.
Yeah.
Virtue is a habitus, and it gets translated as habit. And so people tend to think of virtues as habits.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we look at the habits we have now in the habit literature. But while it's the same word, they don't actually mean the same thing. So the habit literature we think about now is like reflexive habits, like cue, response, reward.
Yeah.
And there's something in there that we can mine. The habit literature tells us you need a cue. There's an action or process that unfolds, and then you need to be rewarded. And the more you do that, the more this habit becomes ingrained, the easier the habit becomes, right?
Okay.
But in the habit literature, very often, it's talked about in a sort of mindless way. So the cue happens, and you just sort of robotically engage in the habit loop. Virtue can't be that, because virtue has to be like praiseworthy or blameworthy. It has to be volitional.
Right.
I have to choose. It can't just be an automatic response. And so there's a tension here, which is like it's meant to be done with ease and like second nature.
Yeah.
And but it still has to be a human act. It still has to be chosen. It's virtuous precisely because I could not do it. It's virtuous precisely because I chose to do it. And yet it has to be, it's not like I white knuckle chose it either. And so part of what Brandon and I were trying to carve out in our first paper on this topic was, is there a psychological space, research base that is related to habit, but a sort of intentional habit?
Yeah.
Habit that isn't mechanistic, habit that can be altered or intervened upon. So it can sort of, it's like an intelligent habit, if you will.
Yeah.
And we think we found maybe a literature base that could support this. John Barg, I don't even know if I'm saying his name right, to be honest, Barg, has this sort of goal-oriented habit where the end toward which it's ordered plays a more significant role in the habit itself, and yet you can intervene. And this is important. Maybe this is too niche, but some of the habit literature says at some point, habits become goal insensitive. Like the goal that you're ordered toward doesn't matter anymore because the cue kicks it off.
Yeah,
the cue kicks it off. And what we want a habit that can still keep a goal in mind, or even a changing goal, the habit can be
used.
And so we think we found this sort of literature base that can begin to open up space for, can psychology help us think about the kind of thing that virtue is.
Yeah.
And we need something in psychology that is, has sort of cues, can feel like second nature, is still intelligent and volitional, can be open to sort of a creativity. Virtue sort of has a sort of creativity about it. It can be applied in new and various ways.
Doesn't look the same in every way you live out a virtue.
Exactly.
You act it out. Yeah, right.
And habits tend to, you know, like,
yeah.
And so that's some of this exciting work, but it's not easy. It's not just like, oh, habit, virtue.
There's some difference.
Yeah.
And there's something about the brain. It's like, yeah, it's like getting the brain into a state where it's easier to choose in a sentence, is even though it's not reflective of what you're getting yourself into point.
And then we've got, I mean, we're working against, in many ways, these habits, these intellectual habits we have. There are ways we see the world.
Yeah.
They're just intellectual ways we see the world that don't make certain, that make certain virtues really hard.
Yeah.
And these are sometimes ways that were given to us. Our family's values, our family's politics, our family's, these are ways of viewing the world that might make generosity or forgiveness or mercy really hard, because we sort of are in a habit of seeing or perceiving the world in a certain way.
So how does faith help? Like, is it easier, do you think, for a Catholic or a Christian to work out these,
at least
these
in theory
because they have a framework for them, but like being a virtuous pagan or a virtuous atheist, right?
I mean, I think in theory, you know, what's really tricky is, I think sometimes we sort of intellectually assent to the dogmas and doctrines of the faith.
Right.
Like, say, I believe that.
Yeah.
But I think oftentimes what you see on a very practical level is folks who tend not, and I don't even know how to make this distinction, but they tend not to maybe really, really, really deeply believe it or something like that. Meaning, if you ask any Catholic at the university, describe God's attributes. He's one, he's holy, he's good, he's omnipotent, he's omnipresent, he's merciful, he's kind, he's just, he's... and then when you actually measure... So this is some of the research I've done on God image versus God attachment.
Yeah.
How we report God as being
versus
how we actually relate to him on the emotional, social level. Overwhelmingly, students report God as merciful, loving, kind, caring, forgiving, generous. And then when you actually measure on the sort of social, emotional level, how they relate to him, it's fearful, insecure, avoidant, anxious.
You're like, what?
But any one of them would pass a catechism test like that.
Yeah, interesting.
And so, there's a way, I'm sure philosophers and epistemologists have some category for thinking about how, whether maybe these are like deeply held beliefs or how we think about the degree to which beliefs actually influence our behavior. I can sort of assent to a set of beliefs, but not have them influence my actions in a meaningful way. Not actually hold them in a way that shapes like worldview. I mean, like our faith gives us a worldview. I mean, it's supposed to be like Dan.
Yeah,
I mean, it's actually supposed to be like, when I see you, I see a creature made in the image and likeness of God.
Everything changes.
Yeah. And I think very often we don't. I think we hold it as like proposition,
intellectual side,
and
we draw out here if we need it,
exactly. And so like, I tend to act out of my actual worldview, but then I'll be like, oh, I shouldn't have done that because you're a creature made in the image of likeness of God. I should say sorry, and I go say sorry, but like my worldview of you doesn't deeply change. And I think maybe that's part of what, you know, really trying to grow in faith and is trying to allow this worldview, and part of it's, you know, in some way, mysteriously, the action of grace.
Yeah.
And some of it, I think, is psychological. I think we can, whatever language you want to use, we can have defenses or avoidance or things that sort of make switching our worldview hard or challenging or scary. And so we avoid doing it. But I think part of growing in faith is allowing this worldview, like our faith, to take on the character of being a real world view.
Yeah.
It's an interesting exercise to sort of ask yourself, like, what does my faith believe? And then, like, how do I actually approach the world?
Right. That's good. Gets back to so your first question, your first back in the beginning, what is it like to be virtuous or to what does it mean to take those on? Even though I know objectively those are good. Do they infiltrate into who I am?
And you know, I think sometimes too, we think a lot about virtue as like around flourishing. And, and this is really great. I mean, this, I mentioned the positive psych literature. And some of the, there's various models of like what it is to flourish, but virtues are about human flourishing.
Yeah.
They're about human well-being. And what positive psych has recognized is that well-being is usually around the domains of positive emotion, engagement, or feeling some like some flow state dialed in, right, to what I'm doing, being engaged, relationships, having meaning, achievements, or purpose. Okay. But what it hasn't done a great job at doing is like couching suffering in there.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about our faith, I think, is that our faith tries to help us appreciate that virtue takes place in a fallen world. And like to really, at least on this side of heaven, human flourishing has to somehow account for suffering. You know, like, can I flourish? Can I flourish in this fallen world, in a world of like hurt and brokenness and selfishness, and in a world where I don't always do what I want to do, in a world where I don't always see the truth clearly? Like, is flourishing possible? And somehow suffering has to take on meaning and purpose.
Right. Yeah.
If for me to flourish here.
Yeah.
If it doesn't, I think we're thrown into a terrible state.
Right.
And so that's something that's like unique. Our worldview, the Catholic worldview, the Christian worldview gives an account of suffering, and it gives an account of how we can begin to make sense of the mystery of suffering.
Yeah, it is the potential of the ultimate meaning.
Yeah.
In suffering.
Yeah.
And it's hard to, you know, intellectually you can know that.
Yes.
To experience that in suffering is
it's
a grace and a gift to get there, right? Because otherwise it's a nihilistic existence.
Yeah. 100%.
Or we recoil from suffering and hey, just get away from me.
Yeah. You know? And that's that's already sort of a deep impulse, right?
Yeah.
Which is like we want to sort of oftentimes. In psychology, we call it distress tolerance, frustration tolerance. We have deep desires to avoid or get out of or diminish suffering.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
and we oftentimes buy this sort of lie that I'll be happy when I'm not suffering anymore. And suffering could be financial suffering. It can be my child not listening. It could be issues with my spouse. It can be we sort of implicitly hold this worldview that like suffering is impeding my happy. I can't be happy while I'm suffering. And so I have to spend all my time avoiding, diminishing, or fixing my suffering. And then we're actually not moving in a meaningful direction. If my day in my life is about diminishing and problem solving all my suffering, turns out suffering isn't going anywhere. Not in this life.
You can't.
Anyway,
yeah.
Right?
It's never gone.
No. And so now that has become your mission and focus, and all the things you want to be doing, being the kind of husband, father, right?
Like, yeah.
You're not moving in a meaningful value direction.
Yeah.
And so our worldview makes sense of suffering. It gives us, but part of what it does is say like, look, suffering is going to be with you. It's not my book. I mean, I thought this was interesting. I came to a definition of healing. One of my definitions of healing is to be free to love the way we were created to love. And I kind of say what that is, to provide the goods and to desire the goods for others the way we were created to, and to receive them, to be open to receiving the goods that we were meant to have. But another definition that I sort of stumbled upon as I was writing was to be healed is to be able to suffer well. That so many of us don't know how to hold suffering. We're reactive to it. It pricks our ego and our pride, and so we want to crush or justify or fix. And we don't know how to just hold suffering and distress, that I can hold it and not let it dictate my life, not let it dictate.
That
to me is, and this is, again, in our worldview, Christ says, pick up your cross and follow me. like hold your suffering, right? But move in the direction that I'm inviting.
And that's the only way you're going to be whole, right? And we think the exact opposite.
We think the opposite.
I think the exact opposite.
The exact opposite. Yeah. All the time.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, that's excellent. Well, you know, just, you know, I know just from knowing you, you're always got a million things going on.
Yeah.
So what are you up to now? What projects are you working on?
Yeah. So I have two projects. I mean, it's funny. In a lot of ways, I think when I first started academically, I had like a lot of academic peer-reviewed papers.
Yeah.
On various topics, religion and spiritual struggle, God attachment. And I was really interested in that sort of empirical stuff. Like, the more I'm living life, the more I realize I want stuff that can like practically meet people and touch people. And my focus seems to be more and more clinical and less interested in using sterile jargon. And so I'm working on a book proposal. I was invited to work on a book proposal on the heart. And so understand, like, what is the heart?
You think an anatomy physiology class.
Does
it go beyond that?
That's interesting, though, right? Because, like, why does the Bible use that? I mean, the ancients they didn't have all the anatomy and physiology, but they certainly knew, like, the heart pumped blood and that it was a vital organ. It was, right? Why does scripture use it 900 and some times?
Yeah.
What is the heart? Is it irrational? Can we trust it? When I say, like, my heart knows something, can I trust it? What role should it have? And so, like, Augustine says, our hearts are restless until they rest in you, O God. What is that? What is the heart he's talking about?
Yeah.
Certain folks have devotions to the Sacred Heart of Jesus, but not the Sacred Mind, Sacred Head.
Yeah, right, yeah.
So anyway, I'm really interested in sort of what's the historical, but then also sort of very practically. All my work these days is like very practical. I want to help people like grow and change. I want to make change accessible. And so then I want to know, like, how should we live from the heart? Is there benefit to it? Is there something about intimacy and vulnerability and for men, for women, for parents? Does the heart offer some key to living the way we're meant to live?
Yeah.
And there's some scripture passage that says something like, within the heart lie the highways to Zion. Like the path to heaven is in and through the highways of the heart. The heart is like the way there, in and through the heart. And so what is that? What's that look like?
Yeah.
How can we begin to live from the heart? So I my proposed title was Leading from the Heart. And I Googled it, and it turns out Coach K, Duke's old basketball coach, that's the title of his autobiography.
Okay.
So I'm not going to take that one. But that's the idea.
Well, maybe people buy the book.
He and I look. So, you know, I'm working on that. And I'm also working on, I run cohorts of this program I developed. I'm really interested in helping people, we talked about this, deepen their identity as beloved sons and daughters of the Father, God the Father. So we have this worldview where, you know, we have the Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. People talk about Jesus quite a bit. More and more and more, when I'm talking to people, I see they have a very hard time with God the Father.
Yeah.
And that's influenced, I think, in some theological way by the fall, this distrust of the goodness of God, and also by our parents that serve as this initial template for how to view close, intimate relationships.
Right.
And I've worked on and developed this program with another therapist in Minnesota that relies really heavily on the attachment literature. It relies heavily on some of the identity literature. And we created exercises and crafted a rhythm, a 12-week rhythm of life, putting down technology, turning off lights and using candles, like learning to create space for self-reflection, encounter, reducing distraction, confronting oneself, and then having exercises that invite them into this like metacognitive awareness and into a space of being open to seeing how they think about the Father, and a space of receptivity, a space of curiosity.
Yeah.
Where we think that and have seen that like God shows up. God the Father shows up. And we've worked with, we have priests, we have religious, we have
That's great.
It's been beautiful. And so we're wrapping up a cohort now. It was called Known embraced by the heart of the Father. And the goal is, I think, I see students, I'm sure you see this all the time. Hey, Dr. Keebler, what should I do when I graduate? I might go to the priesthood. I might get a PhD in biology. I might be a missionary. Or I was thinking about going home and helping my ailing grandmother. And I don't know what I'm supposed to do with that. And I think what I was struck by was how many students came to me and asked that question, and they were driven and motivated by fear, anxiety, a sense of owing something to other people. They weren't free to actually decide. They thought they were choosing what they wanted, but they were choosing what reduced their anxiety.
Yeah, interesting.
They were choosing what they thought like other people would appreciate.
Yeah, and that's a time where that they very prone to that.
Very
big,
prone.
Big decision to leave college. Yeah.
And so I thought, at least what I was seeing was, I don't think we can answer that question until you first know that you're loved.
Yeah.
Until you know you're loved right now. Like, you are beloved. Nothing you do, say, right? Like, when you know you're beloved, you can choose from a place of freedom.
Yeah.
But if you think you have to earn people's love, you have to impress people, your accomplishments are what give you value, you're not going to be able to trust your judgment. Like, I can't trust my judgment when I'm acting from this place of needing the attention, affection, and to be valued by others, the esteem of others. It's when I know that I'm loved unconditionally that I say, this is what I wanted.
Right.
And I trust it. And so this program came out of that. How do we help people know that they are like unconditionally loved and valued? They are beloved right now.
Right. How can people find that program? Like, if they're interested in it.
Yeah. If you go to knownbythefather.com.
Okay.
Knownbythefather.com and sign up. And we have this really cool policy where I never want money to get in the way of this kind of stuff. I can't stand that sort of charlatan.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
So we have called the Good Steward Policy. So we have a price set on the program. If you can afford it, great. If you can't, you tell us how much of a discount you need, 25, 50, 75, or 100%. And it's no questions asked. If you say, I need it for free, it's yours for free. Like, I don't need to see proof of income. I don't need it. It's yours for free. I don't care. Yeah, I don't care.
That's great. Yeah.
And we've just seen tremendous fruit out of that. So,
great. Well, this has been a great, great conversation. I really appreciate you sitting down and spending so much time with us.
Well, I'll admit I'm jealous I couldn't be there, because this is a topic that is so interesting. And I think overall, you look at the topic of psychology, there's growing interest over the years. I think that really reflects people are searching, people are grappling. There's a lot of hurts and people want to seek that healing.
Yeah. Not only do they want to seek that healing, they also want to seek meaning in their lives. You know, sort of the whole Jordan Peterson phenomenon. What does my life mean? And that's something that psychology, you know, sort of can speak to and look at. What are the things that help us sort of flourish and give us direction in our lives from a psychological perspective?
And psychology is a relatively new science in the world of science as well.
Yeah, it is. And it's in a very unique position, you know, because you see, like, you know, where psychology sits, you know, to the right, or left, depends on which way you land, is the, you know, the biology and the hard sciences. And then, you know, to the left, you know, you have the social sciences and the humanities, and it's sort of right there in the center of the, sort of both of those wings. So parts of psychology are almost, you know, hard science, and then other parts are more social science and more humanity based. But it's focused on sort of the human person and how the, as we were talking, you know, Dr. Bruninger and I about, you know, how does it speak to, you know, what, how the human person is ordered and designed to flourish, and you know, what happens when, you know, that breaks down, and how do you heal that? But also for someone, how do we better interact with other people in society by being a better version of ourselves, you know?
Well, we're in need of a lot of healing in a lot of places. So really grateful to hear that conversation. Thank you, Dan. And now that you've asked, you know, Matthew Bruninger questions, I have some questions for you as we turn now to the office hour segment of the show. So I recently saw this news article. You immediately came to mind. The Catholic Polytechnic University in Los Angeles has announced it will welcome its first inaugural class of students in fall 2024 after it's received its license from California. Jennifer Nolan, who is a neuroscientist, she is a mother, she's now the president of Catholic Polytechnic University. She says she wants to build a culture that immerses its students in the Catholic faith while giving them a firm background in science as well. So I saw this, I immediately thought of you. Have you heard of this university, and what do you make of it?
Yeah, no, I've talked to Dr. Nolan over the past couple of years. I'm actually a scientific advisor for the university.
Right.
And, you know, I think the she's trying to build where students don't have to make a choice between getting a good science education or going to a good Catholic university. And, you know, as a Franciscan University faculty member, that's what we try to do as well. But,
yeah,
you know, a lot of, you know, she lives out in the West Coast. A lot of students don't want to go that far away to Franciscan for school. So
to Ohio.
She's right. Exactly. So building something there in California that can marry both of those. And so it's great to see them get into this stage and be able to launch their first class in the fall. And the other thing they want to do is really try to make it affordable. So the students actually get sort of a hands-on internship throughout the whole time. You know, they're starting, I think, focusing on computer science, I think, in particular, and sort of build out from there. But not only do you have this Catholic culture, good science program, but you also get something that's affordable and hands-on, so you can sort of earn money while you're going to school. So it's a great concept. I hope that wish them all the best.
There's room for both, room for Franciscan, room for CPU. And again, if that means more faithful Catholics who are excellent scientists, our world needs more.
Right, exactly. Yes.
Our world needs more Dan Keeblers.
I don't know about that, but this
well, this was also another news story I saw that, again, seemed right up your alley that I wanted to ask you. Members of the Strategic Council of the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine, big, long title, they've examined some new data which reveals that less than half of the U.S. public believes scientists can overcome human biases. What do you make of that? Are you surprised by that? And is that dangerous for the fields of science that it seems, again, less and less trust in our scientists?
Yeah, yeah, it does. I mean, it's not surprising given the way, you know, things, different public debates about science tend to really be driven a lot by political beliefs, you know, whether it was COVID or pro-life things, that it's hard to separate the science from the politics a lot of times. And I think people picked up on that. And, you know, science is, it's a human enterprise, I always say, so it's going to have human biases. But the idea of the doing science as a community, a scientific community, is that as a community, we correct for those biases. Mm-hmm. The problem is when the whole community has the same bias, then you don't correct it for those.
Yeah.
And it can hurt the field of science. You know, there's certainly people are less likely to fund, they want to fund science or want to help science, you know, with you know, government funding, if they think it's just biased at its core. So, I think it's a clarion call to scientists to be and try to maintain objectivity, you know, about their data, even though you have your beliefs and biases, that you have to be willing to follow the data and not you know, have a preconceived conclusion before you do your experiments and so forth. So,
and hold each other accountable.
And hold each other like accountable. Yeah, exactly. Which can be challenging.
Yeah, no, I can't even imagine. But again, reflective of where we're at in this time and the reality of our culture right now.
Right. Yeah. And scientists are becoming public policy advocates, and you know, so there's blurring lines between what scientists used to do and what they tend to do now. Yeah, yeah, right.
Well, Dan, thank you so much. And that wraps up this episode. I want to remind you, go to modulacenter.com for all the latest on Purposeful Lab. Make sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. And we'll be back next week for the final episode of Purposeful Lab, a Modulacenter podcast. So make sure to tune in. We'll see you then.